This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when she was known as the Queen of Scream, and after Halloween, Terror Train, and Prom Night, some people wondered if Jamie Lee Curtis would ever break out of horror films. But the comedies Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda took care of that. TV audiences know her from the sitcom Anything But Love, and she starred in the thriller Blue Steel, which has just been released on home video. Jamie Lee Curtis grew up surrounded by movie stars. Her mother is Janet Leigh, who starred in Psycho, The Manchurian Candidate, and Touch of Evil. Jamie's father, Tony Curtis, starred in Some Like It Hot, The Sweet Smell of Success, and Spartacus. Tony Curtis and Janet Leigh separated when Jamie was 3. She grew up with her mother. Jamie Lee Curtis and comic Richard Lewis can now be seen in reruns of the ABC sitcom Anything But Love. It will return with new episodes as a mid-season replacement. Lewis plays an erotic hypochondriac, not unlike the character he created for his stand-up routine. Lewis is a comic, Curtis is an actress. I wondered if that made a difference in how they each approach their characters.
I really think that although Richard being a stand-up and having a very definitive personality, I actually believe he's playing very much a character. And Richard never improvises on our show. That's not an opportunity that he's had. These scripts are all scripted, and you know they've taken his energy as a performer, and I think channeled it into a TV character very well.
How are you both matched up?
Oh, in the original pilot of Anything But Love that we did that did not sell, I was signed up originally, and there were two men in the show, and we auditioned many hundreds of people. And Richard came in. He was on my list of maybe 5. And I had never really seen him work. I had seen like 2 minutes of an act on a cable show and had seen photographs of him and had just got a feeling from him that I thought we would work very well together. And he came in and was so funny in the audition that he was, out of anyone who came in, the only person who really made me laugh and just relax with them. You know, everybody else, it was like, here we are acting together, and he just let me react with him, and it was so clear that we had something.
You've described your childhood, growing up in the Hollywood area, as growing up with royalty. How would you compare the kind of Hollywood experience with, growing up with your mother, Janet Leigh, who was a Hollywood star? How did that compare to royalty?
First of all, any recollection or point that I make about my childhood, you know, is always made from a retrospective position. It's being made as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
As an adult, I look back on my childhood and imagine that when you have famous parents, particularly Hollywood celebrities who are risen above a status, because they're bigger than life on the movie screen, they were both beautifully, physically beautiful people, very talented, and the public loved them so. There is a royal sense. I remember going to Disneyland and having one of those VIP tours. You know, I never had to stand in a line. It was just that part of my life. It was when I was a child, I didn't remember this. It wasn't like as a child I thought I was a little princess. And as a child, I was a normal kid. I had a great time. My mother wasn't like walking around. I'm saying that the perception of my parents was that they were. My mother raised us in a rural area of Los Angeles, almost a countrified atmosphere, up a dirt road with a donkey outside our house in a corral. I mean, we lived in the country. We were raised a very natural existence in California, but certainly not a glitzy glamo one, which is not something my mother adopted as a personal lifestyle at all.
Did the studios do any publicity around your birth? And if so, I was wondering if you read the articles or saw news clips when you were older.
Well, certainly now, in retrospect, I have many of these funny old Life magazines and photo plays. You know, people have told me all my life, I remember when you were born. And it's not something that I walk around going, a lot of people know when I was born. It's hard to talk about this because I really want to impart that this is not something that I think about. It's not something that I apply to my life or my daily life ever. it is a fact that this happened. And yes, my parents were huge stars at the time, and my birth was a big deal to a lot of people.
Were there any fantasies that were made up about your family at around the time of your birth? I mean, looking back, can you separate fact from fiction? The Hollywood publicity offices were really famous for just constructing lives that would be glamorous, you know, for making things up about their star.
I read these things and I don't believe that one word is attributed directly to my parents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was made up. I think every single word was made up. Or they would take the fact of that Janet and Tony were married and they had a baby and, you know, our life is blessed by our baby Kelly or, I truly believe that it was just manipulated, which was nobody wanted to know about the sort of downside. You know, now it's very cool and couth for public figures to sort of come clean with their personal lives. But then I think it was just that sort of manipulation of what people wanted to hear.
What was the downside when you were young?
Well, you know, my mother has written in her autobiography, she had been married twice before she met my father. And she was so afraid that someone would uncover this early marriage and make it, you know, a tawdry tale. I'm sure there was unhappiness in my family toward the end of their marriage. I mean, they divorced 10 years, you know, they divorced 10 years after they were married, but they both remarried immediately. So you can only assume that their marriage was crumbling for many years prior to their divorce. That must have been difficult. I don't know. It's not something I've really ever spoken about. It was not a pretty thing. I'm sure it was very difficult. And if you have any personal problems or any personal traumas that go on in your life, whatever they are, and certainly should not be brought up today, but nowadays it's very common for people to come to speak of those and to talk about how they affected the person now. Then I think people didn't discuss anything. And I think it led to a lot of alcoholism and, you know, a lot of problems in people in the 50s. I mean, I think I'm talking about a generational thing, not only in Hollywood. I think it was just not the time that you talked about all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it only was personified more in Hollywood.
You're a mother now. Your daughter is two or three?
My daughter's three. Three and a bit.
What are you doing as mother to? I imagine you want to give your daughter as much of a quote normal upbringing as possible because you felt that you were brought up in this, you know, like royal.
No.
That people saw you as royalty.
Yeah, please understand
I really do understand. But it's a feeling I figure you might not want to impose on your daughter.
My husband and I both are fairly private people. My husband being a very private person. And I choose to live a normal life really normal as I can live. And my big attempt with my daughter, besides just helping her create a real sense of herself so that if someone does want to know her because she's my daughter particularly, that won't face her, that she will know that she has a very unique and very individual personality, which she does just naturally on her own. She's just a spark of a child. I will never subject her to any of the publicity side of my business. That's a choice that my husband and I have made very consciously. If I'm being photographed in my home, my daughter will not be in the pictures with me. If I'm on Entertainment Tonight, she won't come scampering in the room. You won't see pictures of us on the cover of Good Housekeeping. I'm going to try very hard to keep her separate from that at all costs, so that she can make the choice when she chooses if she wants to do that. If when she is a choice-making young adult and chooses to pose in a picture with me, fine. But I want it to be her choice and not one that I impart on her.
In Blue Steel, Curtis plays a rookie cop who's tracking down a psychopathic serial killer. I asked her what was new for her in this role.
Well, I hadn't done a lead in a film in a long time. It's certainly is a very passive character in a very action film, which for me was a real challenge. The whole role for me was a reactionary one. You've seen the film, I assume.
Yes.
Everything happens to her. She very rarely instigates what happens to her until the end of the film, when she realizes that that is her only avenue. And that's a very challenging thing to do, to try to impart a performance in a reactionary mode, to try to stay clear of any preconceived notions of what's about to happen in the film or what's about to happen in her life, mm-hmm. and just be pure in her in the reactions. It was a big challenge.
Did you have to learn how to handle a gun for this one?
Yes, I'd never fired a gun before. I'd played Annie Oakley in one of Shelley Duvall's Tall Tales, which required me in 6 days to look, pretend that I knew what I was doing, which was pretty insane. I'd never fired a real gun before, and wanted very much to be able to fit the requirements of the technical side of the role, and needed to do that by going into, you know, a little bit of background work, and also basically going to a shooting range and learning how to fire a gun. And I learned how to do that. I went in L.A. a little bit. Catherine very much wanted me not to spend a lot of time with police officers in Los Angeles and wanted me to be able to concentrate on NYPD. And I did that. I came here, hung out with a couple people, and went to a shooting range often, every day, a couple hours a day. And it became a sport after I tried to deal with the first time you have a gun in your hand, you deal very much with the moral issue of guns and the power of the weapon and how you own your own personal feelings about guns and gun control. And then after you sort of get over this catharsis and this sort of very emotional moment that I really did have, it became a sport and it just became target shooting. And then you try to, like in any sport, get competitive and you try to finesse so that you could get a better score.
Jamie Lee Curtis is my guest. I know when I was growing up, I had so many fantasies that were based on movies that I'd seen. And I'm thinking that when you...
Tell us a few. We want to know.
Never, never.
We here in America want to know.
But I'm thinking when you were growing up...
Tyrone Power in a pair of jodhpurs anything to do with those?
But your parents were in the movies, and unlike my parents, and all of their friends were the movie stars. So I was wondering if the movies, like, were they a part of your fantasy life, or did they just seem like what the parents do when they go to work?
No, unfortunately, one of my saddest feelings about being raised in Hollywood, if there really is something that I consciously, as an adult, look back on and think I wish I could have changed it. Because I saw and knew movies, the magic is broken for me. And I was never, as a child, like I'm sure so many people who are not from the movie industry, are enamored by films and have a really romantic, powerful relationship with going to movies. Many people talk about, particularly filmmakers and actors, talk about all their lives going to the cinema, all their lives being taken to movies and watching. And I just didn't have that. Although I was shown films, they did not impart a magical quality to me. It was more just a very sort of cutthroat, this is the movie, but da 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 da. And I wish I had that sort of magical dream of being in the movies, that people sit back in that dark theater and think, I'll be up there someday. I didn't have that fantasy.
Since, you know, growing up in Hollywood, movies were so work-related to you, when did you decide you wanted to act yourself?
Well, again, growing up in Hollywood, you know, they were work-related in the sense that my mom and dad did them, and I would go and hang out on the set on occasion. You know, I was in school most of the time, so you don't go hang out very much. And again, I don't have any recollection of when it was I decided to do it. It just was, you know, really by chance that it happened that I'm an actress today, because a tennis teacher I knew was sort of turned into a quasi-manager, and he wanted me to go up for Nancy Drew, which I didn't get, but I guess there was interest in who this little girl was. I was in college at the time and ended up in California on a month's break and did an independent study on just sort of how to break into show business. And I ended up signing a contract with Universal Studios for right at the end of that month, right before I was supposed to go back to college, and never went back.
This is Universal TV?
Well, at the time it was Universal. Well, I mean, it was MCA Universal. They were the last studio to still have a contract system, very much like my parents. I mean, the ironic thing that, in fact, nobody's brought up very much, and I find interesting, is that both my parents were contract players when they first started acting. They were young people. My mother was discovered, literally discovered. My father was in New York. He was discovered, brought out to Hollywood. Both of them grew up on the studio system. And in fact, I was one of the last actresses in the world to be under contract. Literally 7-year, 6-month option, their option contract, where I got paid $235 a week. And they disbanded the contract system about 3 years into my contract. But I did. They farmed me out to do Halloween. They lent me out. I mean, it was a real contract system. Sharon Gless, mm-hmm. myself, Delta Burke was under contract at some point. Andrew Stevens.
Were you groomed to be a certain kind of actress by Universal? Because you know, in the contract system, you were often groomed to be a certain type for certain types of roles.
No, one of the reasons I think the contract system disbanded was at one point Universal had like a monopoly on primetime television. And so it was very convenient for them to have sort of a crop of young actors that they could still had to audition for parts, but they were paying them a fairly small amount of money and giving them experience. And the hope of the contract system always is that you're going to groom a young star, that one of these times you give this person a part, it becomes huge, you've got this person under contract for no money, and you basically have a very hot commodity, which you're not paying a lot of money to and you're making a lot of money on. The problem with the current contract system that finally disbanded was that they never took it that final step. They never had the material or the bravery to sort of give one of these contract actors the big break. They just never had the guts to go with a contract actor. They always went with like some other person from the outside. And so they really disbanded it. Whereas in my parents' generation, you know, they did, and they also, in my parents' generation, there were acting teachers afforded to these contract players. They taught you how to dress and makeup, and they groomed you in as either a, you know, the fresh country girl or the femme fatale or whatever. There was no support given to these contract actors except a paycheck every week and the knowledge that they would get a good shot at getting some episodic television. That was it. So I think another reason it disbanded is that it just wasn't, in a modern society, it's just not feasible to have that.
So what did you get? What kind of roles did you get in the 3 years that you had this contract?
Well, I did two lines on Quincy was my first job. Then I did an emergency. Then I played a biker chick on Nancy Drew. Then I did one other show there, and I can't remember what it was. And then I did the pilot for a series at Universal called Operation Petticoat, which during the shooting of the pilot, it was a 2-hour movie of the week that was a backdoor pilot is what they call it. And in the middle of shooting that 2-hour movie of the week, we got picked up as a series. So all of a sudden, I was on a series for a year. Operation Petticoat, 1978.
So Universal Studio loaned you out to do Halloween. How did you get the part of Halloween? It was your first movie, wasn't it? Starring role in a movie anyways.
Oh, certainly. It was an audition. Like, you know, when you're a young actor, you audition every day. And it was just another audition. I just went in and read for John Carpenter and then came back and read again and then came back and read again and got the part.
I know Halloween was considered the first in the slasher films and everything, but really you were the kind of heroine in it who was important because you weren't the passive victim. You were being stalked by the psychotic killer and you were fighting back and you won. And that was kind of a breakthrough in a lot of ways, really. Were you aware of that at the time?
I was aware that I was very glad that I was upholding the strength of women. I also was playing women with intelligence. Mm-hmm. I was playing the high school brain. I was playing what we all hope are the good virtues of young women, you know, women who are intelligent, who read, who study, who are good friends. I mean, I really believed, even though I was being slammed up against the wall by the women's groups, that I was in these what seemed to be exploitation films. I was not being exploited. I felt I was upholding very, you know, I mean, in the context of real life, we're talking about a horror movie. But in it, since it was my only job and I was a young woman, I felt I was holding up the real, you know, the best that I could be as a woman in that in those films. I certainly was never playing the slut or the little tease or any of those that would be easily exploitable parts. I was playing the good girls, and I was very happy to have that role.
Two of the movies you're best known for, Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda, are comedies. Did you have to learn how to get the timing for a comedy, or did that just come naturally to you?
I've been sort of ham-like a lot, and I guess I've had a dormant comedic background without really ever having the guts to say I did. I think to say that you kind of want to do comedy is a very bold statement. It almost imparts a confidence in yourself as a comedian, and I didn't have that. And so it was sort of a, you know, I needed John Landis to come and say, you know, you should audition for this movie. I also was playing fairly straight characters in both those films. If you look back at those films, you know, I am not the yuckster in there. I'm pretty much a very straight character in a funny film, and I've learned more than anything I've learned on my show, how to relax, how to work on my timing, how to redo timing if I've done it well in the, earlier in the week and then sort of lose it by the end of the week. I try to come up with techniques to help me get back to a certain timing that I liked better on a line or something. But I've certainly learned a lot more doing my show.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this.
Jamie Lee Curtis. Her TV series, Anything But Love, is now in reruns and will return with new episodes as a mid-season replacement. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.